This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Keith Preston. We're going to be discussing his new book. It's called The Tyranny of Political Correctness, Totalitarianism in the Postmodern Age. Keith, great having you back on the show.
Thanks for having me back on, Robert.
And I'm also joined with my co-host, Alex von Goldstein.
It's great to be on with you guys.
Keith, you in your book, you get really into sort of the origins of political correctness and what it led to and how it's sort of become totalitarianism in its current form as it is today. You start off your book talking about some of your personal experiences when you were active on the left.
Yes. Well, I've been involved in decent on radical politics for probably about 30 years, almost 30 years. And certainly when I first started out with this, I was a part of the far left, the very far left, the anarchist and Marxist-oriented strands of the left. And that was really my first exposure to what is now called political correctness. It really wasn't called that back then. In fact, it wasn't called anything because it hadn't really worked its way into the mainstream society.
When was that term first coined?
Political correctness. The story is that the way it found its way into mainstream society is actually through the Doonesbury cartoon strip. Apparently, there was a cartoon strip in a feature in Doonesbury many years ago, probably well over 20 years ago, that referenced political correctness, and it had to do with the political correctness as it was growing up on college campuses at the time. When I was on the far, far left back then, the political correctness that we see now was just starting to appear on university campuses, and you didn't really have it in the mainstream society, but you did see it in the university campuses with things like speech codes and things of that nature. That kind of stuff was just starting to get introduced back then. And like I said, this is almost 30 years ago. But what I have found interesting about it is that political correctness has really, I don't know if blossomed is the right word, but it's really grown. It's mushroomed in such a way that it's found its way into the mainstream society and into institutions where I certainly would have never thought it would be found. For example, even today you can find political correctness in the military. I've had conversations with military veterans, guys that have been in the Marines or women that have been in the Marines or the Army or the Air Force or something like that. And they talk about the politically correct indoctrination and training that they get there. I know I've seen this personally in the corporate world. I've seen it in the corporate world now where you get a job with a large corporation and they put you through orientation. And a big part of that is being indoctrinated into the PC ideology about how to respect diversity and not engage in sexual harassment and all of the usual stuff like that. So this has gone from being a very fringe, marginal movement to being something that's now mainstream just in a relatively short amount of time.
I mean, I saw this over the last few years being involved in kind of like DIY punk scenes and seeing people kind of adopt this PC language. I mean, like, I didn't know that it was PC at the time. I just thought it was kind of the way that people were going to speak, a sort of progressive way of looking at things. And as soon as I saw it leave that DIY scene I was a part of and go into the mainstream, I knew there was something really wrong.
Well, it's something that, as I said, it started in the university campuses and then the far left subculture. And then it gradually worked its way into virtually all institutions. It found its way into the media, into the government, into the corporate sector, into education on a more general level, into institutions that are normally thought of as being conservative, like the military, into virtually everything, into mainline religion. As an example of how extreme this gets, a few years ago, there was an incident at Fort Hood. For listeners that aren't in the United States, Fort Hood is an American military base. But there was a an incident at Fort Hood where a Muslim guy who was in the army, apparently he was actually sympathetic to Al-Qaeda or to the jihadists or something like that. But he went on a shooting rampage and killed a number of people. And when that happened, some people raised the question of, well, perhaps we shouldn't have people who are jihadis in the army, or perhaps we shouldn't have Muslims in the army at all. And one of the top-ranking officials in the U.S. military, a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, which is the major governing body of the entirety of the armed forces, said, well, you know, we can't let this incident undermine our commitment to diversity in the armed forces, because if it did, it would be an even greater tragedy than the shooting. And so what he's essentially saying is that, you know, not having, say, Muslims or some other, quote-unquote, high-risk group for terrorism in the army is worse than mass murder. So that's how deeply entrenched, you know, when a guy from the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the military, of all places, is saying this. So this is a set of ideas now that has become part of the ideological superstructure of the state of in the United States and in most other Western countries, certainly in Western Europe. I don't know about Eastern Europe, but what I mean by that when I say ideological superstructure, it's actually a Marxist term, but it's based on the idea that states and ruling classes, power elite systems in any kind of society have a ideology that is used to justify their own position of rule and their own position of power. And it could be the belief that the emperor is a sun god, or it could be the divine right of kings, or it could be Sharia law. It could be the Marxist idea of the dictatorship of the proletariat, or it could be the glory of the fatherland, or the belief in the supremacy of the Aryan race, or anything. But right now, in modern Western industrialized societies, this political correctness stuff really is the ideological foundation of the state, in the sense that it's what gives the state its legitimacy and its ideological justification. And well, it takes older ideas. It takes older ideas like liberal democracy, popular sovereignty, the social contract, and all of that.
Human rights.
And then, yeah, human rights, and it superimposes all of this political correctness on top of it, to where, well, what's the purpose of the government? The purpose of the government is to, you know, fight out racism and sexism and homophobia and transphobia and combat climate change, and you know, the government exists to advance all of these progressive causes. That's really the ideological superstructure of the state as we understand it now.
What do you see as the origins of political correctness? Would you say it got started out of the Frankfurt School, or would you say it goes back even further than that?
Well, that really depends on how further back we want to go. There have always been ideas out there in circulation where you've had people that want to reconstruct human nature or human society along some kind of prescriptive utopian lines. You can go as far back as the ancient world. You can read The Republic by Plato, or you can go to the medieval world and look at, say, a book like Utopia by Sir Thomas More. You've always had ideas like this, you know, this idea, well, if you can essentially redesign humanity, if only you've got the right people in charge, or the right set of ideas in charge, or the right kind of institutions or whatever. But modern political correctness is often traced by people on the right through the Frankfurt School, and I partially agree with that, in the sense that some of the ideas that came out of the Frankfurt School in the 1920s have certainly influenced the development of political correctness. The idea of the culture industry that you see in Horkheimer, the idea of critical theory, in particular Herbert Marcuse's idea of repressive tolerance, a lot of Theodore Adorno's idea, like the authoritarian personality, all of these kinds of ideas have certainly shaped the intellectual culture out of which political correctness has emerged. And, I've heard it said that if the, all the godfathers of the Frankfurt School were here today and visited a modern university campus, they'd probably be considered godlike beings, you know, because their works are so revered among the left today. But I think it's an overly reductionist perspective to attribute the growth of political correctness entirely to the Frankfurt School, because I think it actually represents political correctness actually represents a convergence of a lot of different things. And the influence of the Frankfurt School is one, but there's also Antonio Gramsci's idea of the idea that before you can really have a socialist or a Marxist or an egalitarian revolution, you first have to come to control the cultural institutions, the institutions that disseminate ideas like education and the media and religion and things of that nature. There's also the influence of what is called progressive Christianity. Dr. Paul Gottfried's done some pretty interesting work in this, where he talks about how in the United States you had a situation where old-style Calvinism in New England developed into Unitarianism, and then it developed into a type of secularized or semi-secularized progressive Christianity. But through all of these currents, you see this idea of the old Puritan idea of a city on a hill or the city of God. But all of it is about creating some kind of utopian kingdom of heaven on earth, where the lamb lies down with the lion and things of that nature. So I think the influence of progressive Christianity is certainly an aspect of this as well. Another influence on political correctness is Maoism. Keep in mind that the 60s culture, the 60s 1960s protest movements and all that kind of stuff occurred during exactly the same time that the Cultural Revolution was going on in China. And a lot of the more fringe elements within the student movement tended to be very heavily influenced and strongly admired Maoism. And a lot of Maoist ideas like self-criticism found their way into the American left directly from Maoist China. In fact, you know, some of the really extreme far-left groups that you saw back in those days, like the Weathermen and Weather Underground and stuff like that, were heavily influenced by Maoism. Certainly some of the fringe sectors of the Black Power movement, like the Black Liberation Army, were heavily influenced by Maoism. So you start seeing this concept of self-criticism that you find in Maoism and imported into the American left. And I think that kind of stuff has been a factor that has shaped the development of political correctness. Another thing is privilege theory, in particular white skin privilege theory. In the mid-1960s, there were a couple of American communists named Ted Allen and Noel Ignatieff. And these fellows were the real deal. They were members of the American Communist Party. But they developed this idea of called white skin privilege. And what they did was they took the work of W.E.B. Du Bois. He was a black sociologist that had lived earlier and who was still very influential. His work is very influential. And Du Bois had made the argument. Du Bois was a Marxist, but Du Bois argued that blacks in the United States were really not so much a proletarian class as they were sort of a sub-proletarian class in the sense of being almost like a caste, like a kind of like the Dalits in India or something like that. That's kind of, I guess, a rough analogy to Du Bois' ideas on this subject. Now, Du Bois didn't believe in the kind of ideas about race and struggle that the left past today. I mean, he didn't see race conflict in terms of blacks and whites per se as necessarily antagonistic. He just believed in that, you know, blacks needed to obtain rights within the context of the American Republic and, you know, get their citizenship rights and all of that kind of stuff. But what these American communists, Allen, Ignatieff, and some others did in the 60s was they took some of Du Bois' ideas and they developed this theory called white skin privilege, which is basically the idea that, you know, white people just by virtue of existence are oppressors or are privileged just by virtue of skin color. And this kind of idea started to find its way into some extreme groups in the New Left. I mentioned earlier the Weathermen and groups like that. They were big on that. The white skin privilege was a favorite term of groups like the Weathermen. But for a time, this kind of thinking really existed only on the far fringes of the left, you know, the really crazy Maoists and stuff like that. But in the 1980s, what happened is that these kinds of ideas, privilege theory, started to show up in academia, in mainstream American academia, in humanities fields and social sciences and that kind of stuff. There was a landmark work by an academic named Pat Peggy McIntosh that was published in the 1980s, and it really outlines, you know, this privilege theory, and it, that book is sort of a Bible now for you know, privilege theorists or whatever. But the whole idea, obviously, behind privilege theory is that people are essentially assigned categories of privilege based on birth. You know, it's the idea, well, if you're a man, you've got male privilege. If you're white, you've got white privilege. And then presumably there's straight privilege and, you know, Christian privilege and non-disabled privilege or age privilege and things like that. And underlying all of this is this idea, well, if you belong to any of these privilege groups, then you are by definition an oppressor. You know, you're oppressing, say, blacks just by existing if you're white, or you're oppressing women just by existing if you're a man. And this kind of thinking permeates really the entirety of, certainly the entirety of the thinking of the radical left as it exists today. But increasingly, it's finding its way into mainstream liberalism as well, and it's finding its way into, as I said earlier, into institutions, into mainstream institutions, into the state, including a lot of institutions that you normally think of as being conservative, like religion or like the military or things like that. But the this stuff, this privilege theory, is applied to virtually every aspect of social criticism now that these people adhere to. For example, there was a work published back in the 70s by Susan Brown Miller. She was a feminist, a radical feminist, called Against Our Will. And she was arguing, she was really one of the pioneer theoreticians of this thing that's called rape culture. It's the idea that, you know, when women are raped by men, it's not simply that a man is committing a crime against a woman, rather it's the whole culture that's responsible. You know, the culture of patriarchy, you know, the culture of male privilege is responsible for the crime of rape. So, you know, men are essentially complicit in rape largely just by virtue of being men. And that kind of idea has continued to be developed by, you know, radical feminists and academia. And now it's starting to be applied in the actual policies that you find on university campuses about sexual harassment and that kind of stuff. You know, it's the idea, well, if someone accuses you of sexual assault, if you're a man, you're guilty until proven innocent. And it's the same way with all of these different, you know, privilege categories and oppressed categories. And the one thing that they do with this stuff is they make just very broad generalizations about entire categories of people, you know, based on some fairly superficial characteristics. You know, they're saying that, well, whites are privileged by virtue of skin color. Presumably that would include, you know, the poor whites that live out in Appalachia, where you've got people living in abandoned school buses, and, you know, and they stick a pipe through the ceiling of a shanty for heat or like a chimney or a wood stove or something. You know, there's no distinctions, there's no qualifications or things like that. So all of these factors have really converged to make political correctness what it is. I think the influence of the Frankfurt School is part of it, as well as Gramsci, as well as Maoism, as well as progressive Christianity, as well as radical feminism, as well as probably a number of other currents that could be identified as having contributed to the development of political correctness.
So it started out as like a leftist activists and groups, you know, like the Weather Underground, and then it spread through universities, through college professors. Then from there, it infiltrated the media, and then corporations, the police state. But at what point did it really sort of infiltrate these major institutions like corporations, the media, and law enforcement?
I think that a change started to happen in probably during the 1990s. I started to notice during the 1990s that there was a shift in a lot of rhetoric in a lot of mainstream institutions where things started to take an increasingly leftist sounding tone. One example of that was in the 1990s, I was interested in movements like the militia movement and stuff like that. And that the militia movement had actually emerged in response to what happened at Waco, Texas in 1993, for younger listeners, there was a in 1993 there was this cult that was based in Waco, Texas, and they were believed to possess some illegal weapons, and they were accused of other crimes and all of that. But anyway, the federal agents, the ATF and all of that, conducted a raid on these people, and there was a shootout, and a bunch of people were killed on both sides, and then there was a standoff between the cult and this compound and federal agents, and eventually the federal government, you know, sent in tanks and basically rolled them over. About 100 of these cult members were killed, and, you know, it's some controversy remains about, you know, who actually did what, you know, like who started the shootout, and, you know, whether there was an incident of excessive, you know, police action. And then as far as when the tanks attacked the compound, there was a fire that killed the remaining cult members, and there's always been this question of who started the fire. But anyway, the there was a militia movement that started in the U.S. in the 1990s, and these were, you know, mostly gun enthusiast type people who saw what happened at Waco was an attack on the right to bear arms. But anyway, when this movement came along, a lot of these watchdog organizations like the SPLC, the ADL, and the Political Research Association, and a lot of these other kinds of groups that are, you know, these political watchdog organizations with a liberal or left slant that are always trying to identify, you know, incipient racism and anti-Semitism and all of these other things in different movements or ideological currents. I started noticing that they, in a lot of this, there was a decidedly, on one hand, it was certainly had a leftist slant to it in a way, in the sense that it was attacking the right, you know, for being homophobic and all of that. But it was also defending law enforcement and defending the federal government. And I started seeing this kind of convergence happen in the 1990s, where it seemed to be that the radical left and the establishment, you know, the state or the power elite or whatever, were coming closer together. And I've seen that escalate ever since then. You know, more and more I've started to see, you know, this kind of left ideology about privilege, and, you know, we've got to stamp out homophobia and racism and sexism and all this kind of stuff, find its way into more and more institutions. The trajectory, the historical trajectory that you outlined was correct in the sense that it really did start with the far fringes of the left and worked its way into academia and in the media and then on into more other institutions, the corporations, the government agencies and all of that, to the point where it became dominant or hegemonic, as the left would say. But the I don't know that we can really say, well, there was this any one thing or any one catalyst that pushed PC into the mainstream. I think it's been a gradual evolutionary process, and I think also it's also really escalated in recent years, certainly in the last 10 years, probably in the last 5 years. And in part, I think that has to do with younger people. I think we have nowadays a lot of people, you know, more and more people who've never grown up without political correctness. You know, like a lot of these kinds of ideas I never heard of until I was an adult. You know, I had no idea what a transgender person was until I was in my 20s, you know. But this kind of PC ideology, I think, now is being fed to younger people through the public school system in some instances, certainly through the university system, certainly through the media, also through plenty of other institutions. I work in one of the lines of work I'm in has to do with publishing, and academic publishing is a part of it. And I'm always reviewing academic curriculums as part of the work that I do. And what I've started to see now is this very hardline leftist social justice warrior, whatever you want to call it, ideology is really starting to permeate academic curriculums in colleges, you know, and I'm not talking about major universities like Brown and Harvard or something like that. I'm talking about these online degree mills. I'm talking about community colleges, and I'm talking about not just in women's studies and ethnic studies and queer studies and fields where you would expect to see this kind of thing, but I'm starting to see this kind of ideology find its way into things like nursing and like the social work profession and journalism and mass comm and in all of these kinds of humanities fields and all these kinds of professions. You know, they spend a lot of time talking about what they call cultural competency and cultural sensitivity. You know, I look at a lot of of curriculum that's used in business schools, like in HR training and marketing and all kinds of things. And it's unbelievable how much effort is put into things like this, developing cultural sensitivity in the workplace, you know, developing cultural competency in international business exchange and all of these kinds of things. So, like I said, this kind of thinking is really finding its way into a lot of different areas of society. You know, like I said, certainly in all of the social work, social services type professions, medicine, lots of other stuff, law. You'd be surprised, but there are, you know, so this hardline PC ideology is taught in a lot of law schools now.
As political correctness loses its intellectual legitimacy, do you see it becoming increasingly dependent on the police state and outright tyranny? In one of your chapters, The Myth of the Rule of Law and the Future of Oppression, you point out that there's a lot of trends in American society, massive military-industrial complex, mass immigration, and demographic transformation, rapid economic deterioration and disappearance of the conventional middle class, and the growth of a general apparatus of state repression, and these trends, including the prison industrial complex. And these are trends that have happened over like the past several decades. What do you see these trends leading to in American society? How will they relate to political correctness? And as I said earlier, will more outright tyranny be used to enforce things as the intellectual legitimacy wanes?
Well, I've been saying for years that the more deeply entrenched PC became in American institutions, or institutions generally, not just in America, but in other places where this kind of thinking is prevalent, I've always said that the more institutionalized it became and the more entrenched in institutions it became, the more it would be willing to show its fangs. A problem that a lot of people have with recognizing the dangers associated with PC is they think that PC types are just do-gooders in a hurry. You know, I don't know how many times I've had, you know, more liberal-minded people tell me things like, well, look, you know, at least they're fighting against real injustices, you know, discrimination against gay people, or you know, historic oppression of black people, or you know, discrimination against Muslims or whatever. You know, that's a kind of a way that a lot of people use to gloss over or ignore real problems associated with PC. But I always said that the more deeply entrenched it became, the more the PC types would actually show their real fangs and show themselves for what they really are. And we're seeing that. We're seeing that in particular with the kind of stuff that's going on with these social justice warrior people in universities. And we're seeing it in the universities, not only among the students, among all these crybaby students that have to have their trigger warnings and safe spaces and all that kind of stuff, but we also see it even among university administrators and faculty who give assent to this kind of stuff, who push these kids into doing this kind of stuff in many instances. And we're seeing it starting to work its way into other institutions as well, the legal system, for example. One advantage that Americans have that some other countries don't have is the First Amendment. So because you have this idea of free speech being legally enshrined in the First Amendment, it's a little harder to impose restrictions on speech in the name of curbing hate speech and enforcing equality and all that kind of stuff. But in European countries where they don't really have that same tradition, certainly hate speech laws are becoming more deeply entrenched. I mean, in Sweden and places like that, if you're a Christian minister or a Muslim cleric, you can be brought up on legal charges if you say you disapprove of homosexuality. I remember a few years ago coming across a case where the police in England and some jurisdiction were gathering data about supposed expressions of racism among children on the playground and that kind of stuff. I came across a case in Britain once of something like an 11-year-old was arrested by the cops for you know, calling a Pakistani kid a bad name or something like that. PC really is an ideological movement. Recognizes no limits on its own power, you know, as long as it's crusading in the name of social justice. And I think this is really one of the key points that has to be recognized, because we have to understand that, particularly in the United States, that we have this massive military-industrial complex that's as large as it's ever been, as deeply entrenched as it's ever been. We have this massive police, modern police state apparatus that has grown up over the past 40 or 50 years through really the war on drugs that Richard Nixon began in the 70s is really the foundation of that. But we also, it's, you know, since that time, it's been expanded into not only the war on drugs, but really the war on everything, you know, the war on drugs, crime, guns, gangs, you know, all of these kinds of things have been used as a pretext for expanding the police state in a lot of different ways. You know, I could do a whole program or two or three or four on the police state and how that operates, but we really have seen this deeply entrenched police state develop in the United States in recent decades in a way that's essentially shredded a lot of the traditional constitutional rights, like rights of the accused, stuff like that. But we have this police state. We also have this widening class divisions. We have this widening class divisions now where class divisions in the United States are now wider than at any point that they've been since before the Great Depression, so about 100 years. And we also have the cultural polarization that's going on, you know, between the red states and the blue states and the left and right and the, you know, all the different component parts that make the cultural conflict what it is and social divisions what they are. A part of that is has to do with demographic change. You know, some of that is the fact that, you know, the demographic change has taken place and that there's elements of social conflict that's emerged from that. Like, for example, you know, when Donald Trump was giving a speech in New Mexico recently and there were some protesters that turned violent when he was made his appearance, and a lot of this had to do with, you know, resentment of comments he's made about Mexican immigrants and things of that nature. So all of this is creating a system of polarization and social conflict and, you know, the balkanization of the United States into a lot of different conflicting ethnic and cultural and religious and everything else communities. And one thing that's also happening is that in recent times now we've seen a backlash against political correctness. We've seen a guy like Donald Trump that comes along running for president and just kind of gives a jab in the eye to PC and things like that. And we've also seen the growth of the alt-right movement, and that's really, really started to grow in the last few years. You know, I was around when the alt-right began, you know, and I remember when Richard Spencer coined the term alt-right and he started alternativeright.com. I was one of the first staff writers he ever had there. But I've really seen the alt-right grow significantly. Now it's become an almost mainstream idea of the alt-right. But what's happening, though, is that as we see society balkanizing, we also see this PC thing becoming more deeply entrenched in institutions. It's becoming a lot more extreme, a lot more fanatical. It's working its way into the actual legal system as well. You know, it's not just people yelling at each other on college campuses or things like that. I mean, this is stuff that is gradually being incorporated into law. And what I think that signifies is the power elites in the United States and in the Western nations. And when I say the power elites, I'm talking about those who actually control the corporations, the banks, the state, the military, the police, the legal system, you know, all of that kind of stuff. You know, as I said, all ruling classes, all states have a self-legitimating ideology that they use to justify their existence. And increasingly in the Western industrialized world, that's political correctness and all the things that are attached to that. And increasingly that ideological system is being used as a smokescreen, fanning the police state and expanding the state to where the state intrudes into every aspect of life, ostensibly in the name of enforcing PC ideology. One example is the gay wedding cake thing. You know, the idea that, well, if you have a religion that says you don't approve of gay marriage, you don't want to bake a wedding cake for somebody that wants to have a same-sex wedding, well, then you can be taken to court, put out of business, fined hundreds of thousands of dollars, things like that. Increasingly, this kind of stuff is finding its way into criminal law. We certainly have the, you know, ideas like hate crimes and all that kind of stuff. But more than that, I think, you know, in European nations now you have hate speech laws, the rape culture, the implicit assumptions behind the hysteria over rape culture that you see among the radical feminists is that men who are accused of rapes essentially should have no defense, should be considered guilty until proven innocent. And more, we start to see justification for state repression against dissidents on the grounds, well, there's these people out there that are into racism and sexism and homophobia, and they might be engaged in terrorism or acts of violence and things like that. So that's used as a justification for surveillance and repression and infiltration of dissident political organizations, along with the war on terrorism. That's a rather disturbing phenomenon as well, because the fact that we now have these anti-terrorism laws that were put into place by the neocons and George W. Bush after September 11, where the state can essentially detain you for indefinite periods of time without trial if you're considered a terrorist suspect or things like that, where the state can essentially kill you without charge or trial if you're suspected of being a terrorist. Imagine taking the PC extremism that you see coming from the social justice warrior camp and fuse that with the police state that's been built up around the war on drugs and the war on crime and all that, thanks to Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton and some other people, and with the war on terrorism that the neocons put into place. Imagine all of that converging, and you get what I'm talking about when I talk about totalitarian humanism.
This rhetorical shift to the left that you mentioned, I think that a lot of this is like predicated on an assumed moral authority that progressive thought has, like quote unquote progressive thought. And do you think that a lot of this is rooted in like the way that, this might sound a little crazy, but the way that we view history and time itself as moving towards something? And like, is this rooted in like Abrahamic religions?
Well, yeah, I think that on a more intellectual level, that's certainly true. If you look at the core ideas that you find in leftist thinking, remove any issues or anything like that from it, just focus on the ideas, which you will find is that, it can really be broken down to four or five basic sets of ideas. And that is, one is universalism, that people and cultures and societies are largely interchangeable. They're no different than Pepsi and Coke or McDonald's and Burger King or something like that. They don't regard cultures as the unique products of particular people or circumstances or whatever. It's more or less just interchangeable. So universalism is one, and related to that is egalitarianism. Leftists are very loath to recognize any kind of inequality among people, the idea that some people are smarter than others, are healthier than others, more physically fit than others, simply have more ability than others, more self-discipline than others, better character than others. That's not something that really figures prominently into leftist thinking in a lot of ways, at least not in any kind of consistent way. Another view is the one that you mentioned, which is this kind of linear view of history, the idea that history is evolving towards some end game, some final purpose. And utopian thinking tends to reflect that. I mean, utopian thinking is generally about, well, in the future, when we get things right, we're going to have this kind of perfect utopian society, or we're going to evolve towards something better. Whereas rightist or conservative thinking doesn't really look at it that way. People on the right, I've noticed, tend to have a view of history that's either more cyclical, civilizations rise and fall, and cultures come and go, and cultures can stagnate and die, even if they've once been very prosperous. Or they might believe that history is more just random. Things happen, and historical development is just a product of circumstances. But the left does tend to have a view of history that's more in line with the kind of apocalyptic religious ideas that you find in some of the certain kinds of Christianity, or probably Judaism or Islam. The idea of the permanent battle of good and evil, and the culminating in the day of judgment and the coming of the kingdom of heaven and things like that. I mean, in the leftist language, if you spend any time around really hard leftists, you'll hear them use language where they it's clear they have this kind of dualistic, almost mannequin view of the world where, you know, there's the good guys, the progressives, you know, who are on the side of enlightenment and truth and progress and human rights and human goodness and social justice and, you know, equality of, you know, anyone and everyone and all these other things. And then you have the bad guy reactionaries who, you know, who just exist to impede progress, and they're just all about maintaining privilege for undeserving groups and oppressing minorities and you know, women or whomever.
Thing is, if you view those people as people who are basically evil or immoral people, then it's easier to kind of dehumanize them and like get rid of them rather than thinking of them as people you have an intellectual disagreement with.
Well, yeah, and I think actually that's one of the most dangerous things about this PC ideology is the way that they divide human populations into these polarized opposites, and they make these assumptions about people based on, you know, very narrow and generalized categories, and in a way that they dismiss entire classes of people as somehow morally unfit or in that particular sense. And you know, what the fixation that they have on privilege, for example, is particularly disturbing, because if you look at the history of things like massacres, genocides, ethnic cleansing, you know, purges of that particular type, you know, a lot of people, I think particularly Americans, have this idea of, say, genocides or, you know, ethnic cleansing or intercultural violence as being something where you have some oppressed, beleaguered minority and then some evil regime comes to power and killed them or something like that. But if you look at the history of things like ethnic violence and stuff like that, just as often, if not more often, the victim of things of that nature, genocides, ethnic cleansing, violent purges, have been people that were considered unduly privileged in some way. For example, in the ethnic massacres that you saw in Southeast Asia and Indochina at the conclusion of the Vietnam War, Pol Pot, for example, or in Cambodia, or the boat people, the Vietnamese boat people, the refugees that came to the United States, you know, they kind of washed up on the Pacific Coast after being expelled from Vietnam. A lot of those people were ethnic Chinese who were considered unduly prosperous or unduly privileged under the former colonial system or whatever that they had in those countries or their more traditional societies. I remember seeing a television interview years ago with a woman from China who had grown up she'd grown up in pre-Maoist China, you know, under Chiang Kai-shek, and she came from a family that was, you know, middle class, upper middle class, you know, somewhat well off. And she talked about how under the Maoist regime in China, she was actually put in prison, and the crime was she had prospered, or her family had prospered under the former regime. You know, in other words, she was considered to be an oppressor just on the basis of her, and a criminal, just on the basis of her class background that she was born into, you know. Mao Zedong actually once said that, you know, there's no such thing as human nature. There's proletarian human nature, there's bourgeois human nature. So in that particular system, they really more or less do different social classes as almost the equivalent of different species or something like that. You do find this kind of thing in a lot of leftist thought where you're labeling people as privileged or as oppressors just by virtue of existence. You know, and the communist regimes that existed around the world in the 20th century, and which at one point controlled about a third of the world at their peak, those systems were notoriously bloody. They were notoriously repressive. They would engage in large-scale repression against classes of people based on these kinds of things, based on alleged privilege. They would persecute religious believers and religious minorities. As far as other examples, in Idi Amin's Uganda in the 1970s, there was a genocide program carried out against Asians who lived in Uganda, you know, on the grounds that they were, you know, external, you know, colonial oppressors or something like that. And the Rwandan genocide in the early 90s, the situation there was you had one ethnic group that was actually a smaller ethnic group. But they had been favored by the Hutus. No, they'd been favored. I keep forgetting who was the victims and who were the perpetrators. But the Hutus
were the perpetrators.
Yeah. Okay. The Hutus were the perpetrators. That's what I was thinking. Okay. So the Hutus were actually a smaller ethnic group, but they had been favored by the Belgian colonialists when Rwanda was a Belgian colony. So what the Belgians had done was they had actually created this kind of elite class of Tutsi administrators and overlords and things like that. And then when the massacre happened in the 1990s, it was billed by its sponsors as a retaliation for this class having been an oppressor class or having been privileged under Belgian colonial rule. And I could go on and on and on with examples like this, but you do see this kind of thing historically. You do see the fact that situations where you have violence, ethnic cleansing, genocide, the kulaks in the Soviet Union were another example of this. It's always a case where you have people that are somehow labeled privileged or oppressors or exploiters just by virtue of existence, irrespective of what they personally do. That's another aspect of PC that's rather troubling, in the sense that the idea that's implicit in PC ideology, or sometimes explicit, is that groups, the people are defined as good or bad based on group identity. It has nothing to do with what you do as an individual.
It's like original sin.
Right, exactly. Being a white male is like being born into original sin. Groups that are deemed oppressed are by definition virtuous, irrespective of what they individually do. For example, we see that in some of the controversies over issues involving police brutality in the United States. Now, police brutality in the United States really is an issue. We have this massive police state and prison industrial complex that's been built up around the war on drugs and stuff like that. All of that stuff is an issue. So the people on the left who raise those issues, I'm not totally discounting everything they're saying by any means, but I've also noticed there's this tendency that whenever an accused black criminal is killed or injured in a scuffle with the cops, there's always an assumption on the left that this guy must be a victim of police brutality. He must be a victim of racism. This must be an unjust killing of an innocent a young black man or something like that. There's rarely any effort to try to look at the actual facts of the case and say, well, what were the cops actually doing? Why did the cops stop this person? What was the accused person actually doing?
It seems like they always pick these cases where there's a bit of mystery going. Like, it's never as like, there's plenty of cases they could pick that are like clear videos of someone being shot by police. Like, I remember there was a video of a black guy who got shot in the back by a white cop, but I have no idea what that guy's name is. But I know who Trayvon Martin is, and I know who Michael Brown is, and these are both cases where you essentially have to pick a side. Most people don't do the research.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that, in the sense that the worst cases of police brutality are not the ones that get all the publicity. There are cases of police brutality that I know of that most people have never heard of, that if they're not interested in the subject. There are many cases where it's no question as to that the cops were in the wrong, that the person who was, assaulted or killed or whatever was a victim of police brutality. But the cases that get all the media attention are the ones that seem to be more dubious in nature, where there's a lot more gray area. The one in Ferguson, Missouri, is a good example. My take on that personally is I really don't know what happened. Everything that I ever read about that case from different sides and different perspectives was such that I just said, I don't know. But it's usually the case like that that the cases like that that the left really goes crazy over. And I think that a lot of it is rooted in this mentality that poor inner city black folks are by definition virtuous because they're oppressed, you know, irrespective of what an individual
Paul Gottfried said that that white leftists, like the PC Gentile, he calls them, see black people as like sacred objects, and because he will always sort of refer to cultural Marxism or political correctness as like a religion. It's a replacement of Christianity.
Oh yeah, I think it is. And if you spend any time around the social justice warriors and other true believers in this ideology, they really are like religious fanatics or something. I mean, they really are like the Jehovah's Witnesses that come and knock on your door on Saturday morning to try to get you to come to church or something. They have a completely cultic ideology that is totally impervious to logic or nuance. You know, there is no nuance. It's just there's the truth. There's the revealed truth, and that's it. And I think that the left does have this habit of adopting populations and individuals as mascots or, symbols of virtue. Thomas Sowell is a black conservative who's actually written about this a lot. And he talks about how white liberals will actually use blacks as a type of merit badge. Like he talks about how he will encounter white liberals who say that, do you know how many black employees I have in my business? Or, do you know how many, what all I've done for black folks or whatever. It really is sort of, I've heard it called virtue signaling in some of these alt-right circles. But I do think that that's a strong element of the psychology that's involved in this. And I also think this duality, where populations, individuals are defined as virtuous, deserving of sympathy or deserving of criticism, based on identity, irrespective of what they personally do, irrespective of what they collectively do. And a sensible way to approach it is, if you have a case of police brutality, it's fine to look at the race and all that of the different parties involved because, it could be a case where a racist white cop, unjustly harmed or killed a black civilian or something like that. That happens. There's certainly cases of that happening. But that may not be the case. It's also the case that in a lot of urban communities, black-on-black crime is very serious. African-Americans are about 50% of the U.S. population, and are about 13.5% of the U.S. population, and commit about 50% of the criminal homicides, with about 90%+ of the victims being other blacks. So all of these kinds of issues have to be considered when we look at these kinds of situations. I mean, and it does. It's not just a race issue. There's plenty of other issues. The rape culture thing is one. There's this idea that, if a woman accuses a man of rape, he's by definition guilty because she's a woman and he's a man. The gay rights thing is one. When I have discussed the issue, for example, of the gay wedding case with people on the left, they'll say, it's just this great affront to human rights and human dignity that you refuse to buy someone or make someone a wedding cake because you don't approve of their sexuality or something like that. And to which I say, fine, they can just go to another bakery or whatever, to the left, this is some great moral crusade. It's like that with the immigration issue. The reasonable people can disagree about what an optimal immigration policy or set of policies would be, but the left looks at it like, virtually any limitations on immigration at all are tantamount to the Holocaust or something like that. It's like, if you want to, say restrict immigration, in order to raise wages or cut down on unemployment or, you're concerned about, contagious diseases from being spread from countries where health standards aren't as high or where certain illnesses are more prevalent or terrorism
and
or anything like that.
The thing with political correctness, it superseded all these other traditional progressive causes like civil liberties, the environment, and economic justice.
Yeah, I find that interesting as well. It really is the case that if you look at a lot of icons, liberal and left icons from past times, you see that Barbara Jordan, she was a longtime liberal Democrat congresswoman from Texas, was a proponent of immigration restriction. You see that Cesar Chavez, you know, a Hispanic American who was, you know, an icon of the labor movement, was actually in favor of immigration restriction. You know, Ralph Nader, you know, he's a, you know, one of the old guard from old-fashioned liberalism or progressivism, is an immigration restrictionist. And it's not just the immigration issue. I mean, as you said, it's free speech, it's due process. Again, this is another issue with political correctness that I find disturbing, in the sense that they seem to have this idea that virtually any and all traditional civil liberties or civil rights can be overturned, you know, in the name of pursuing what they consider to be social justice or equality in the here and now. They'll say, well, free speech, we don't need that if it's just going to be about allowing people to engage in hate speech, or freedom of religion, well, that's just an excuse to discriminate against women and gays, or freedom of association, well, that's just an excuse for racism, or due process of law, well, that just lets male rapists get off the hook, you know, or equality. They don't really believe in equality before the law. You know, one of the achievements of modern liberal Western civilization is this idea that, you know, when you are accused of a crime, you have the right to a trial. It's supposed to be a fair trial. You know, it's supposed to be an impartial judge and jury, and it's supposed to be based on reasonable rules of evidence and things like that. You know, a lot of people, I think, on the left just seem to view cases in terms of, well, what is the identity of the victim versus the perpetrator? You know, the Zimmerman Trayvon Martin case is a good example. I've noticed a lot of leftists just assume that, well, Martin was an innocent victim of murder simply because he was a young black guy. And Zimmerman, I don't think Zimmerman was actually white or Hispanic.
He's like Jewish and Hispanic, but he's white when if he was the one who would have killed, he'd be Hispanic and Jewish. But when he's the one who's the shooter, then he's white.
Okay, well, I guess he was the closest to white of the two
of
them.
Yeah, exactly.
So he's automatically guilty by reason of skin color or something like that, and you see that with virtually any issue of that type.
Do you see sort of an opportunity for an oppositional or dissident movement to take up a lot of these causes that have been put aside by the mainstream left in favor of political correctness, issues like pro-environment, protecting civil liberties, like workers' rights issues?
Yeah, I think that probably that will be the case, at least on some level, because I think what's going to happen is that increasingly political correctness and the forces of global capitalism, of the police state, of big business, you know, of imperialism, of the military-industrial complex, all of that stuff is going to converge. So political correctness will simply be the ideological superstructure of a ruling class that's just not that much different from a traditional ruling class. It's just all about, you know, the economic power of the elite and the state and imperialism and repression. And that in turn would create openings for other kinds of movements to pick up some of these issues that are serious issues and have fallen by the wayside on the left. You know, the old style civil libertarian left doesn't really exist anymore. You know, even groups like the ACLU, even they are more interested nowadays in pushing PC than they are.
They used to fight for like free speech. And if neo-Nazis wanted to have a march, the ACLU would fight for their free speech. And now they would probably be against our podcast right now.
I guess the only example
left of that I can think of is someone like Glenn Greenwald.
Yeah, I mean, you've got a rare figure like Glenn Greenwald or something like that that will defend more traditional civil liberties. Or the environment, you know, the left is big on the environment, but yeah, it would certainly take precedent over. I mean, PC would certainly take precedent over the environment as well. And if it came right down to, you know, either restricting immigration for environmental reasons or not restricting immigration and letting the environment go, they'd let the environment go.
That's what happened with the Sierra Club. There was a billionaire financier, David Gelbaum, who put money into the Sierra Club if they would drop their measure that would say that immigration is bad for the environment.
Yeah, and the that's sort of labor issues as well. The left and the capitalist class have largely taken the same positions on labor issues, particularly when it comes to immigration. Both groups are opposed to any kind of restrictions on immigration, even when it might be beneficial to the domestic working class. In fact, a lot of the hard left has rejected labor issues as well. Among the neo-Maoists and people like that, they tend to refer to workers in advanced industrial societies like the United States as a labor aristocracy. I mean, that's how they view the working class of, say, the United States or Western Europe or somewhere like that. It's a labor aristocracy. So this labor aristocracy is really guilty of oppressing, third world people of third world countries or people of color or something like that. So all of these traditional leftist causes have kind of been thrown by the wayside as political correctness has become the definitive issue with the left. I mean, the left today, if you look at their rhetoric, I mean, what do they care about? They care about racism and sexism and homophobia and transphobia and Islamophobia and xenophobia and, maybe climate change as well. And then they want universal health care or single-payer health care or something like that. But that's really the sum total of their ideology. You know, the sum total of their ideology is really about waging demographic conflict, waging demographic war, if you will, the war against whitey,
I could see these people becoming almost like neocon war hawks. You know, like they would go to war with Vladimir Putin because he doesn't treat transgender people nicely.
Oh, I think that's quite very much a possibility. I see the social justice warriors on one hand, the hardline cultural left that we're talking about, and the more traditional ruling class elements. You know, the war hawks. You know, the military industrial complex, the big capital, and the state, and all of that. I could very easily see that kind of convergence where the military interests of the American Empire are used or justified on the grounds of politically correct ideology. We have to go to war with Russia because they don't respect gay rights. And in fact, that kind of rhetoric has already been used. Look at what the Obama administration did to Libya. I mean, they just laid waste to that society and allowed ISIS to essentially come in and get a foothold there. Under what pretenses did they do that? When it was all about human rights. Look at during the Bush years. You know, look at what the rhetoric that was employed to justify the invasion and occupation of Afghanistan and Iraq. You know, there was 9/11 and terrorism and all that, but also there was you had guys like Christopher Hitchens, a former hard leftist Trotskyite turned neocon, saying we're going to bomb Afghanistan out of the Stone Ages. And you had liberal hawks defending the war in Iraq on comparable grounds, that this was a war against fascism or something like that.
That's like usually you say in a war you're going to bomb your enemy into the Stone Ages.
Yeah. So we've already seen aspects of that. We've already seen aspects of that happening. And I think that I have noticed that there has been a growing antagonism towards Russia on the left because of Russia's social conservatism and their affinity with traditional religion. And, they're not big on gay rights and transgender rights and all that kind of stuff. I could very easily see that kind of thinking.
And the support of Assad. Putin's support of Assad, they also probably shakes their boots.
Yeah. Of course, now I think there are plenty of other motivations behind American foreign policy, behind PC. I don't think that's really what the arms merchants and the oil companies and all that really care about. But it is something that, you could certainly see the left giving support for the neocon foreign policy agenda and the American imperialism and all of this in a wider sense on with a leftist rationale, and you could certainly see the system taking these ideas and incorporating this into their propaganda system and into their ideological superstructure.
We are a bit out of time. Before I wrap up the show, Keith, do you have anything else you'd like to add about your book that I didn't get a chance to touch upon?
Well, the book is available through Amazon.com and from the publisher, Black House Publishing. It's called Tyranny of the Political Correct, of the Politically Correct, Totalitarianism in the Postmodern Age. And it's a relatively short book, but it gives a fairly comprehensive overview of the basic ideas of what political correctness is and how it evolves. And I try not to make it too academic. It's something that it's fairly easy reading, and you can read it in the space of a couple of days without much trouble. But if you want to know more about me, for the people who aren't familiar with me, you can go to our website at attackthesystem.com, attackthesystem.com.
And I've been reading Attack the System, the book, this week. It's really, really great, and I recommend any of our listeners to check it out.
Okay, yeah, it's a good book, I think. Of course, I'm biased, but that book is really the foundation of a lot of what we do at Attack the System. You know, it's a collection of essays I wrote over the years, really outlining the Attack the System philosophy and strategy and all of that. So definitely check out the book Attack the System, which is also available from the same sources, from Amazon and from the publisher, Black House Publishing.
Keith Preston, I'd like to thank you for being on, and also Alex, thanks for being on as well.
It's been great, guys.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.